I love these little people, and it is not a slight thing when they who are so fresh from God love us. As I had felt pleased at first by her confidence, I determined to deserve it and to do credit to the nature which had prompted her to repose her confidence in me. So says the narrator in Charles Dickens' story, The Old Curiosity Shop, as he tells of helping a small child, a stranger, to find her way home in the dark streets of London. Incidents of child abuse and neglect are common today, but there are ways to prevent it, including economic supports, and we'll find out about them from Kristen Slack, professor of social work at the UW-Madison. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, it's a huge topic and one that's constantly changing in some ways, but how did you get interested in studying cases of child maltreatment?
Sure. Well, it's been a really long journey, and initially my interest in child maltreatment came about almost 30 years ago when I was in graduate school at the University of Chicago. And in the early 90s, we were, as a country, debating federal welfare reform. And at the time, there was at least a recognition that among families who got involved with child protection services systems, there most had some recent or current experience living in or near poverty. And so there was a question floating around at the time about how federal welfare reform changes might impact child welfare systems, and particularly the front end of those systems, which is Child Protective Services. So I did my dissertation on this topic and also worked on a study after I graduated in Illinois on welfare reform. And we followed 1,400 families over the course of 5 years in the Illinois Family Study to learn what happened to them as a result of welfare reform policy changes. And, you know, the question is, would changes in family income stemming from these welfare reforms lead to differential risk in Child Protective Services system involvement, or what I'll call CPS involvement, going forward?
Now, when you say that these families were involved in, let's say, incidents of maltreatment, is that involved with these agencies through their own volition ever, or is it simply a matter of, you know, some kind of government entity detecting maltreatment and then more or less coercing them to participate?
It's a great question. It is not largely a voluntary system. There are some aspects to the child welfare system and the front end, the CPS systems, that are often described as voluntary, but for the most part, it is considered a kind of deeper end, involuntary system that most families do not want to end up in. So it's important to understand why some families, and especially some families more than others, get involved. And by involvement, it can mean anything from being reported. It could be someone in a government service system. It could be a medical professional. It could be a teacher. But it could also be your neighbor or a family member that makes a report of a child maltreatment allegation.
Do you have a sense of the proportions of those various?
It's largely the medical and education and to some extent the social service sectors that make these reports. But there is a sizable number of reports that come in either anonymously, so they could be from anyone, or from family members and neighbors.
To what extent are medical personnel, or maybe some of the others for that matter, obligated to report what they think might be a case of maltreatment?
Mm-hmm. We do have mandatory reporting laws, and those were first introduced in the 1970s, and states, if they didn't have them at the time, quickly adopted them after that. So across the country, even though we have no national child welfare system, each state and sometimes counties and localities within each state have their own policies around mandatory reporting. And for the most part, those different service sectors I mentioned are all subject to these mandatory reporting laws.
It would be one thing, I would think, to for a medical person or anyone else, for that matter, to see, you know, bruises that would be an indication of child maltreatment, that could be indications of child maltreatment. But what about the psychological aspects? How often are those reported?
It's a great question. And, you know, most states, their statutory definitions of child maltreatment are fairly lean on definitions of emotional abuse or neglect or psychological abuse or neglect. It's probably the form of maltreatment that's least often reported and certainly least often substantiated or, you know, found, the evidence is found that it occurred. But often because it's very difficult to pin it down. So while I think it has a profound impact, psychological and emotional abuse and neglect, it's not typically the form of abuse or neglect that our child welfare systems deal with.
In terms of child neglect, how would that be defined? I mean, some kind of leaving the child unattended for a long period of time, or malnourished, or how would you find something that would signal neglect?
Sure. Yeah. Before I answer that, I'll just give a couple just quick statistics around instances or reports of neglect, just so you can get a sense of how frequently they occur in child welfare systems. As of the last national reporting, about 75% of kids who become involved with child welfare systems and are deemed victims of maltreatment are deemed victims of neglect. So 3/4 of the kids that have substantiated or founded reports of maltreatment, those reports are related to neglect. That's compared to around 17% reported for physical abuse and about 8% for sexual abuse. And just over 60% only are reported only for forms of neglect. So increasingly, our child welfare system and that front-end CPS system is becoming a neglect response system. But over the last few decades, neglect has received relatively less attention, both in research as well as in program development for interventions around preventing maltreatment. But neglect has some unique characteristics. And like you mentioned, with physical abuse or sexual abuse, there may be physical indicators that a medical professional or teacher might be able to see. Neglect is primarily about omissions of care, right? And omissions of care that in particular create harm or substantial risk of harm to a child. So it's much more difficult to identify and label neglect than it is physical or sexual abuse. It's also the form of maltreatment. It takes on many different forms. So it often the term that's used, it's very heterogeneous. It can include medical neglect. It can include supervisory neglect, which you mentioned, educational neglect. It can include emotional neglect. Whereas physical and sexual abuse is more often about the severity or the egregiousness of physical harm by caregivers.
And easier to see,
right. It's also, I think, with neglect, it's particularly difficult to discern whether situations of potential neglect are related to poverty or to willful omissions of care on the part of a parent or caregiver. So it can make it trickier to understand what to do in those situations if you're a frontline worker investigating these kinds of cases.
I'm trying to think of a non-economic related instance of willful neglect. I mean, how often do you come across a family where the income is secure, but there's still neglect?
Well, most of the families that come to the attention of our child protective systems are living in poverty, or were recently living in poverty, or certainly were living in near poverty. I want to also say, though, that the vast majority of people living in poverty or near poverty do not abuse or neglect their kids. It's just that if you become involved in the CPS system, there is a disproportionate number of families where income is an issue. So there's a clear association between poverty, income, economic stress, things like that, and your risk of becoming involved in this deep end system.
Well, yeah, on the surface of it, you could see that because at the very least, if a parent is working two or three jobs just to keep a roof over the head and mm-hmm. bread on the table, they would have less time and probably less patience to provide proper care for a child.
And they may have fewer options for quality child care. They may have to make decisions between whether they can afford sufficient food this month or pay the rent. You know, often for families, it's a situation where you're making the best choices possible among a lot of bad options, and that elevates risk in the family for harm to a child. Whether or not that parent should be culpable for that risk or whether we need to look to other external factors is one of the things I want to discuss in a bit, but it's certainly a stressful situation to be living in poverty and dealing with trying to stabilize childcare, housing, food, transportation, all while raising children.
Do you have a sense of the percentage of these neglect cases are in single-parent homes?
It depends on how you define single-parent homes. I mean, if the majority are certainly involving non-married parents, but often there's cohabiting couples living together. But single parenthood is a kind of a distal risk factor, if you will, for child maltreatment. It's not something that in the immediate context necessarily has a causal role, but because it's also heavily associated with poverty, you're going to see it show up more often, that kind of family structure in the child welfare system.
So how does the whole process proceed there? Then there's a report of, well, let's start with an obvious sort of case, you know, some kind of physical abuse that you can actually see that a physician or a teacher or someone else reports. Who do they report it to, and what happens next?
Sure. There's several different kind of areas in the child welfare system or different, you know, practice functions. And one of the first things that happens is a report is made, usually to some kind of a hotline, involving an allegation or multiple allegations of abuse or neglect. And the workers who staff those hotlines have to make decisions following, you know, policies and procedures about what kinds of situations may warrant further investigation. In Wisconsin, we call that first line of contact access. These are our access workers in child welfare. And then we have another set of workers that is sent out to do actual investigations if the access workers determine that's required. Once an investigation is occurring, there's a decision-making that goes on around whether the reports of maltreatment that were made should be substantiated or founded. But more importantly, there's an assessment of whether the children in the home are safe. And that safety assessment is really what determines whether an ongoing child welfare case will be opened, and also whether a child or multiple children will be removed from a home or and placed into foster care.
Well, there's one thing we haven't quite defined yet, and that would be the age span. What kind of age are we talking about that would be covered by these situations?
Sure, it's any minor age child. A report of abuse or neglect can occur for any minor age child. The highest incidence of reports is for the youngest kids. There's almost a linear pattern, so the risk of a report to child protection systems goes down the older a child is.
Well, I suppose yes. The more dependent they are, the more labor intensive they would be.
Right, exactly. I did want to get back to two things you asked that I don't think I one of them was around definitions.
Yes.
of child maltreatment. And in particular, I want to just bring up this definition of neglect. And I brought as an example Wisconsin's definition. And I'm just going to read it. Any person who is responsible for a child's welfare who, through his or her action or failure to take action, for reasons other than poverty, negligently fails to provide any of the following so as to seriously endanger the physical health of the child. And with neglect, it's things like basic needs and supervision and medical care, things like that. But it's an interesting definition, and it's a common definition across the states to include this clause for reasons other than poverty.
Yes. That really stands out, doesn't
it? Yes. And that is kind of the crux of the dilemma that our systems face and our workers face in doing these assessments of families and determining whether there's risk or risk of safety in the home. And I'll talk a bit more about that poverty connection. But the other thing you asked me was whether there were instances of neglect that don't involve economic factors. And, you know, it's a tricky question to answer because it depends on whether, you know, almost any risk factor we see in the child maltreatment, in the child protection system has some association with poverty. You know, poverty and lower incomes are associated with higher risk for a whole range of different issues, you know, whether it's mental health problems or physical health problems or substance abuse or involvement in the criminal justice system and other forms of family violence as well. And so poverty's in the mix, you know, more than we realize, but it may not be what's presenting at the moment in terms of why a certain particular family is reported or not. It's a very tricky thing to discern.
When we talk about how these things proceed, then I would think, I don't know, I'm trying to imagine one of these, what would you call it, a caseworker going to a house and sort of gingerly trying to determine what authority they have once they get there?
Yeah, and you know, I've shadowed workers who do these investigations here in Wisconsin, and I have to say that, you know, there's some incredibly skilled people doing this work, and often in the media, child welfare workers will be portrayed as, you know, sort of, you know, the child snatchers or, you know, you know, in kind of a bad light. But you know, I've met many of them over the decades that I've been here in Wisconsin, and that's not usually the frame that they have. It's the hope is that families can stay together and that help can be provided to the family within the context of the home. And without having to remove children, which is a much rarer occurrence in child welfare than maybe the general public believes. But it's, you know, there's also cases and instances of workers whose decisions, you know, come into question. And some of that is related to just the large caseloads many of them have. And it's very difficult to stay on top of everything that's happening in every family they're responsible for working with.
Sure. Occasionally we hear about situations where, yes, there has been a caseworker there following the family and then some egregious thing happens. And the first question is, well, why didn't we catch it?
Yeah, exactly. And the answer is families are unpredictable and situations are unpredictable. And we don't have the ability to perfectly predict what's going to happen in any given situation. And sometimes there's other people involved in the household that maybe weren't there initially, that may be at fault.
Does this process proceed with what interviews? You're asking questions of the adults in the house and of the children too?
Yep, asking questions, making observations, talking sometimes to other service providers or teachers, other personnel involved in the family's lives. So, you know, it is a very intrusive and scary process for families, but, you know, the information gathering can involve a number of different people, usually not only the parent and the child, if the child's old enough to contribute to that process.
How much time do they actually spend in the house?
That, you know, I don't know an average amount of time, but there's quite an extensive assessment that goes on. I mean, I know the content of that assessment, and there's policies within the system that require these assessments be completed over a span of about 3 months, I believe. So they aren't necessarily immediate, but there are certain situations where the circumstances are so egregious or so concerning that quicker decisions are made, particularly around whether a child needs to be removed from the home.
Is there a point at which law enforcement gets involved?
Sometimes they are involved. Sometimes reports actually come from law enforcement who are visiting the home for other reasons or for related reasons. So they may make the call themselves to Child Protective Services, or CPS workers may partner with law enforcement in conducting some of these home visits if there's concerns about worker safety.
If we look at Wisconsin, do you have a sense of how many of these visits are made in the course of a year?
In Wisconsin specifically, I don't have that data available. I mean, nationally, there's almost 8 million children that have some sort of contact with child protection systems, that front end of child welfare, in any given year. The national statistics show that about 1% of the U.S. child population has a substantiated maltreatment allegation in the course of a year. And astonishingly, I find this even hard to say, but over a third of U.S. children have contact with CPS over the course of their childhoods. And that percentage shoots way up if you're limiting the denominator to families living in poverty. And also for Black children, that rate surpasses 50%. These are horrific statistics. And I don't think the general public tends to realize how ubiquitous this involvement is. It's almost a normative experience in some communities for there to be some CPS involvement. And I personally think that's a huge problem.
Well, it would be huge. That's right. And there are other components to it, too, of course. I mean, it's going to spill over into the educational system, and not to mention, you know, law enforcement, employment problem with people getting jobs after certain situations have been reported. I mean, it starts in the home and then spills into all kinds of other aspects of the community, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. And it's very disruptive, you know, in that family, but in the larger family system and community as well. And, you know, there's large communities that have a great distrust of child welfare systems, just as they do the police or law enforcement. Part of that is when you look at our child welfare systems, there's an extensive amount of racial disproportionality in terms of who gets involved at each stage of the process, whether it be the report or the investigation or the child placement stage. And the concentration of involvement with CPS in coming from certain communities is also a cause for concern. And I'm going to talk a bit in a few minutes, I think, about sort of what's behind some of that, and come back to this notion of what is the role of poverty in child maltreatment. But it's hugely concerning and problematic.
Well, let's get to that when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Kristen Slack, and we're talking about preventing child maltreatment and also some of the economic supports involved in that. And we've been talking about poverty with, a not surprising role in child maltreatment, but certainly a surprising proportion or number of children involved in this country.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's... I want to sort of reiterate one thing I said in the first half of the segment, and that, you know, the vast majority of families living in poverty do not experience child maltreatment.
Right.
But the vast majority of families who do get involved somehow with Child Protective Services are or have recently been poor. So what is this role of poverty in child maltreatment, and in particular involvement in child protection systems? So I thought I might summarize some of what I've learned over the last few decades about the role of poverty. One thing is it really can have a direct impact on child safety. So in some situations, you know, just arising from the inability to afford basic needs, even though poverty in and of itself is not supposed to be equated to child maltreatment, that, you know, as I read in that earlier statutory definition.
Right.
it is a fact that in some situations of dire poverty, children are at risk. And so what do we do in those situations? And what role does the child welfare system, or should the child welfare system, play in those situations? So we'll talk about that a bit. Okay. And it can have an indirect effect. So you mentioned earlier about the stress that families may live with if poverty is a hardship for the family. So this link between poverty and both child maltreatment and involvement in child welfare systems can be indirect by influencing levels of stress in the home, changing some family dynamics, maybe parenting changes as a result of an economic hardship in the family. All of these things can lead to an elevated risk of maltreatment and CPS involvement.
And what can you actually do about poverty, though?
Right. Well, historically, it's interesting, in the origins of our child welfare systems in this country, which came about in the early part of the 20th century, there was actual language, even that long ago, that families, should not be separated for reasons of poverty alone. That clause, for reasons of poverty alone, has been there since the beginning. And in putting that in practice, is another issue. But, both seem to matter, both this experience of poverty and parenting behaviors or family situations and circumstances. One doesn't sort of explain away the other. But how do we think about child welfare systems' role in addressing poverty? And I would argue that historically, child welfare systems have not viewed themselves as a system that is meant to intervene around poverty issues. So there's a siloed social welfare safety net in this country, and child welfare systems have often, worked in tandem with some of these systems by referring families to other programs and systems for help with economic support. But it's not viewed as a core child welfare mission. Certainly, child welfare workers and child welfare systems offer services, to help families with situations of economic need. But for the most part, that those needs are addressed outside the child welfare system. So then you have to ask yourself, if most of those needs are addressed outside the child welfare system, yet the vast majority of families coming into the child welfare system are there for reasons of poverty, what's going on with our other systems?
Exactly. Yes.
What are we doing right or wrong in those systems that are not as quote unquote deep end as the child welfare system? Are there ways we can improve those systems so that they function better in supporting families and helping them stabilize so that they never, have to get involved? Their path never leads into child welfare.
Well, it gets into getting to causes, though, doesn't it? I mean, you can intervene all you want if there's an argument or even some violence. You can intervene, but unless you get down to whatever the root cause is, it's just going to come back, right?
Absolutely. And for the longest time, we didn't have very good evidence about whether poverty or economic stress or economic hardship had a causal role in child maltreatment. But in the last decade or so, we've been able to learn from research that uses rigorous experimental methods to try to understand whether the provision of economic support may reduce the likelihood of child maltreatment and CPS involvement. And we've also taken advantage of seeing what happens when there are changes within these external systems, policy changes that can lead to changes in income for families. And there's ways to statistically model those changes to be able to say something about a causal connection. And one example of one of those studies actually was here in Wisconsin. It was a study in the late 90s led by two other social work professors, Maria Kinchan and Dan Meyer. Maria Kinchan is now a dean at Georgetown. And what they were doing was actually looking at child support, and they were trying to determine what happens when you pass through the full amount of child support collected on behalf of families receiving welfare or temporary assistance to needy families.
And before you go on, when you say child support, some people think of that's a form of alimony, but
yes.
Is it just that, or is there something else?
It's a support paid by a non-resident parent. Right. And historically, you know, in the early 90s and earlier than that, the state would collect that child support, and if a child was living with a parent who was receiving welfare benefits, the state would keep that child support to cover the costs of paying for welfare benefits.
Wow, that's interesting.
So there was an experiment done in Wisconsin in the 90s where the question was, what would happen if we just passed through the full amount? The results of this particular study, when we went back to look at the data years later, we linked the data to child protection system events. And the families that got this full pass-through of child support dollars were less likely to have future and to have a child protection services event or a child maltreatment report, if you will. So that provision of extra money actually did reduce involvement in CPS systems.
Well, that's certainly hardcore data in terms of the relationship between poverty and maltreatment.
Absolutely. And there's been several other studies using that similar kind of model that have tried to test this. And there's a lot of consistency when you change policies in these other systems to either that with the result being an either an increase or decrease in income to families, you see fluctuations in risk of involvement with CPS, and that's indicative of a causal connection. And the reason this is important is because these changes in policy have nothing to do with the parents. You know, they're external.
Right.
You know, they aren't about, you know, personal characteristics or unique family situations. They're these external factors that, when they're in play, can actually have an impact on child maltreatment risk. And so that raises the question of how could we improve or better structure our economic support programs and our social welfare benefit systems to be more supportive of families and ensure that they achieve some minimal level of stability in terms of income as a means of preventing child maltreatment.
Is it always a matter of financial support, or can it be, in effect, in-kind support that would help?
Definitely in-kind support, too. And so, you know, there's been studies looking at the provision of child care subsidies, you know, SNAP benefits or food stamps, another example of in-kind benefits. And then there's been studies looking at things like home foreclosures and tax, you know, the earned income tax credit, and TANF benefits, both generosity and
TANF?
Temporary assistance for needy families.
Thank
sorry,
you.
That's our current public welfare benefit system.
How do you forestall a foreclosure?
Well, you know, that whole system, as you know, is under a lot of pressure right now, as it was, you know, back in 2005, 2006, 2007. Housing is probably the number one thing that families say they need when you interview them about what their needs are, families who come to the attention of child welfare systems. It's very hard, very difficult for families to find affordable housing, safe housing, stable housing. And without that, their lives can become very disruptive, which can lead to other risk factors emerging that bring them to the attention of CPS.
So we're talking about what, more subsidized housing where foreclosure wouldn't be an issue, or what?
Yeah, and for the most part, you know, the families that get involved in child welfare systems are largely not homeowners. It's largely
sure.
renters.
Yeah.
But there have been some studies done by For instance, the Urban Institute did a series of studies a few years back looking at housing first initiatives. So when families come to the attention of child welfare systems, what happens if we shore up their housing situation first? Or families already involved in the child welfare system, what happens if we shore up their housing system or their housing situation? Do they leave the child welfare system more quickly?
Do they?
They do, but there's mixed results, you know. So in some cases, they're in the various localities where these studies were done. In some cases, there wasn't evidence that it helped, but in several instances, there was evidence that it helped.
Well, so what else in terms of, let's say, without actually just giving them money, mm-hmm. what else seems to be working in terms of fending off the maltreatment of children?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you about a study that my colleague Lonnie Berger and I worked on here in Wisconsin, and also with Michael Collins, all here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So now it's going on maybe 7-8 years ago, we worked with the Wisconsin Child Abuse and Neglect Prevention Fund on an intervention that was called Project GAIN, standing for Getting Access to Income Now. And what we were attempting to do is to engage families who are reported to CPS, but after an investigation, there was no case open. So there wasn't sufficient safety concerns to open a case. We knew from past research that these families that are sort of deflected from child protection services come back at really high rates. About a quarter come back within a year.
What do you mean by deflected?
No case is opened investigation.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. Okay, so then they are returned.
Yeah, they are re-reported, or there's a recurrence, you know, within 1 or 2 years at higher rates.
Well, that's a useful statistic.
Yeah, and so we thought, you know, what happens when you engage that group in some kind of prevention service voluntarily, you know, just simply offer something to them? And the Child Abuse and Neglect Prevention Fund, Prevention Board here in Wisconsin was pivotal in creating a program called Community Response going on 10, 12 years ago that targets exactly that population. These families that touch CPS but don't actually end up with a case going forward. And Community Response was meant to just be an offer of help. You know, community-based workers external to CPS would reach out to these families and say, hey, what do you need? What can I help you with? And it could be anything. And most of those parents identified economic needs.
I would think.
But a fairly high percentage of them also identified parenting support needs as well. So it wasn't just about economics.
Okay, so in terms of the economic need, that your next door neighbor probably isn't going to help you a lot with that, or this, you know, community volunteer. But when they're talking about actual child care, that's one that, of course, has been in the news lately.
Sure. Yep. With Biden's Build Back Better proposals, child care is a huge piece of that. And it's definitely an area that families struggle with, not only the cost, but also the stability. You know, so that could be something that a family says to a community response worker, I need help with child care. And one of the things the community response worker will do is just help families navigate the various benefit systems and resources available to them. Options for child care being one. And just help them link up to these systems that sometimes are hard to access for a variety of reasons. In Milwaukee County, we had a community response program that exclusively focused on economic needs. So again, targeting this group of families that's deflected from the child protection system after an investigation. And the Social Development Commission in Milwaukee County was the, this is where the program was situated and where the workers were housed. And they worked with families on anything they needed related to their economic situation. And this was a randomized control trial. And what we did then is follow these families over time to see whether they had fewer CPS, child protection events, going forward if they received this intervention. And again, it was mixed results. You know, families that came into the study with the lowest incomes did have a reduction in CPS events following them about 2 years out. But it wasn't a statistically significant finding, although it was a pretty large reduction. But we had other families who had higher incomes where the intervention worked in the opposite direction. They were more likely to come back to the attention of CPS.
How would you account for that?
It's not clear yet, but there are certain clues that we're looking at. And one is that families don't exist in a vacuum. And when they do get help and other members of their network are also economically stressed.
Oh, Uncle Roy's going to want a piece of the action.
They may spread some of that help around and end up further behind themselves.
Oh, wow.
That's one possibility. It could also be things like with that economic support, you might be more able to leave an abusive relationship. But then you also don't have the resources that may have come from that that partner. And so there may be more economic instability going forward.
That's sort of a trade-off there.
Yeah. And so it's not clear yet, you know, why that is. But it's to me, it just says that we have to do a better job at aligning what each unique family needs with the interventions available. You know, we tend to think it's all about parenting. Let's send everybody to a parenting class. And for some families, that may be what they need for some caregivers. But for some caregivers, it may be something really simple. We had an instance of a father who had been reported to CPS and went through an investigation and no case was open. There weren't sufficient safety concerns. But when asked what he needed, he just needed some steel-toed boots for a job he'd been offered, and he couldn't afford the boots.
Well, that's a wonderfully simple solution if that's all there is to it.
Right, and so the program bought him the boots, and we never heard from him again. And, you know, there isn't an emergency assistance program that's like a go-to program for families, but for some families, it can be something as small as that that trips them up. You know, without those boots, he couldn't accept the job. And things can spiral down from there if other options aren't available.
Well, that's certainly the optimum situation if you can, make it possible for somebody to have adequate income on their own. That seems to be, on the face of it, the best solution.
Right. But I also think the kinds, you know, when the intervention we did in Milwaukee wasn't very extensive. I mean, we're talking about maybe a few $100 over the course of the year extra for the treatment group families compared to the control group families. And it's a one-shot thing, you know.
Right, yeah, that's the best kind. Let's get some further thoughts before we close on the future and how things might look in terms of preventing child maltreatment and these economic supports when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Kristen Slack, and we're talking about preventing child maltreatment, and we've gotten into this idea of maybe not one size fits all, but getting down more specific to what each family needs. And sometimes it can be something just very simple, sometimes obviously more complicated. Where do we go from there, from finding out this information about the importance of personalization, Kristen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have sort of several recommendations for how we should go forward with child maltreatment prevention, but this is one of them. Is we have to do a better job at asking parents and caregivers what they need help with. In the last segment, I mentioned the community response program that the Child Abuse and Neglect Prevention Board developed, and it exists in multiple sites around the state. We also evaluated that program, you know, so not the one in Milwaukee specific to economic supports, but just this broader approach of just asking families what they need help with. And we randomly assigned families to be offered community response or not. And the families that were offered community response were just asked that question. You know, there was a conversation with workers about what families needed help with. And we found that families that participated in community response or were in that treatment group were less likely to come back to Child Protective Services over the course of a year.
Can you repeat what you use as a definition for community response? That means outside of these specific organizations.
Correct, yeah. So the Prevention Board created this program external to Child Protection Systems where families could be referred if they were reported to Child Protection but no case was opened in that system. Those families might be deflected. And in this case, they were offered the chance to participate in this voluntary community-based program external to CPS.
And those programs are obviously or presumably set up in a way that you're going to have qualified people participating?
Yes, absolutely. Often housed in family resource centers that have been established and running for some time. Sometimes they're within a county human services agency, and they have dedicated workers to the program. So always in a known entity within a community that many parents are familiar with. But again, you know, that simple ask, what if families need help with, actually did generate a reduction in future involvement with CPS. And it wasn't across the board. It wasn't in every site. So again, it's back to this one size fits all is not the solution. But it's a key element to ask what families need help with.
You would think that would have been done 100 years ago. What do you actually need?
Yes. And, you know, it is done, but in a way that's systematic and in a way that the intervention plan is actually tailored around that. That doesn't always occur. Workers have their own assessments about what families need, and sometimes those take precedence.
It's a matter of listening.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The second thing I would just say is, you know, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for, you know, well over a decade now, almost two decades, has been defining child maltreatment as a public health issue. In part because of these high rates of involvement in CPS that I mentioned earlier. But we don't really quite treat it as such yet. We still are inordinately focused on, quote unquote, fixing the parent, you know, sending them to a parenting class, getting them to change their parenting behaviors or knowledge, and not paying as much attention as we should to the larger ecology that families live in and the multiple systems and neighborhoods and communities they're engaged in. I think if we're really going to move the needle on child maltreatment prevention, there needs to be responses at multiple levels of the environment. It's not just about parenting. It's about these other support systems that could function better to help families thrive or at least achieve a minimum a level of stability. So that's an important ingredient. And I do think there is increasing recognition and movement in that direction. So that's promising. And then, you know, strengthening the social welfare safety net, these other systems, you know, whether it be healthcare, mental health care, substance abuse treatment, you know, these economic support systems like temporary assistance for needy families and SNAP or food stamps, don't tend to view themselves as child maltreatment prevention tools, but they actually are. And so I think we do need to just acknowledge that head on and look at those systems with that lens as a prevention tool for child maltreatment. And how do we make access easier? How do we make improve the consistency of benefits and in some cases the generosity? How do we change the cultures of some of these systems so that they're more focused on outreach and support rather than deflection or trying to reduce benefit levels?
Well, yeah, that would seem to be going in the wrong direction. And I can see where just telling a parent to go to parenting classes, essentially you're saying, well, suck it up because, you know, you're not going to get any more secure. We can't promise you anything along those lines. You just have to be a better parent.
You know, I think one thing that's happening now that we really need to pay attention to is this child tax credit that families have been getting as a result of the pandemic is in a sense, it's a form of kind of a basic income or floor for families that has anecdotally been creating more stability for families. And we don't yet have evidence in about whether it's associated with reductions in child maltreatment or child protection system involvement, but I suspect it will be. So it's something to definitely watch and to try to understand as best we can, because it's a moment in time like no other in terms of the supports available to families that are struggling with poverty.
So this is in addition to the traditional child tax deduction.
Right. The benefit was made more generous and it was spread out to be monthly. So instead of waiting for that credit to come, you know, once a year, families are able to have some floor each month in terms of the tax credit, which has been hugely helpful to a lot of families living, you know, in dire situations of poverty.
Is there a sense, do you think, Kristen, kind of looking at big picture, that the government, whether it's state or national, federal government, think of that as an investment rather than just a handout?
I sure hope that there are people in the government who see that. You know, I can't say that that's a universal view at this time. But I do think, you know, we're not going to see meaningful magnitude of order changes in the rates of child maltreatment unless we do invest in these families and try to achieve some level of economic, you know, stability. You know, and there will still be families who need involvement from child protection systems, even with that income floor and with that economic support. But I think you'll reduce the number of families that are involved in the system because of reasons of poverty. And those are exactly the families we don't want to see in child protection.
And we think maybe the result of preventing child maltreatment will pay off in the educational system with better students, getting better paying jobs, and being more self-sufficient?
Absolutely. I mean, all of these systems, whether they're universal systems like public education, or whether they're, you know, deeper end systems like criminal justice, there are high rates of childhood abuse or neglect, among those families that show up in those deep end systems and among those kids and families who don't graduate or go on to get good paying jobs. I mean, the association with that both childhood poverty and childhood abuse and neglect is there. So if we can address child abuse and neglect by addressing poverty, I think over time, it won't be immediate, we'll see these rates of these concerning rates of child maltreatment drop.
Well, thanks for giving us at least a glance at this whole phenomenon of preventing child maltreatment and the role of all kinds of support, including economic support.
You're welcome.
My guest has been Kristen Slack, professor of social work at the UW-Madison. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.